Welcome to It Shipped That Way, where we talk to product leaders about the lessons they've learned helping build great products and teams. I'm Alan Pike, and today's interview is with Adam Lissagore. Adam is the founder of Sandwich, the best darn video production company out there. Adam's team at Sandwich has introduced countless startups to the world, including Slack, Square, and Figma, and I'm so excited to have him on the show today. Welcome, Adam.
Thank you so much, Alan. I'm really excited to be here. And yeah, Sandwich is me. I am Sandwich. We used to be known more as Sandwich Video, as the complete sort of like object pair. And we rebranded as just Sandwich a few years ago. And as of late, I've been sort of leaning back into the old nostalgia of Sandwich Video because there's something sort of much more tech and product focused about it that I feel like we tried to leave, almost like trying to grow out of it. Like we were more of an ad agency. But you know what? I've just discovered over the past year or so that I really want to return to my roots because a product is where I thrive.
And video is your thing.
Yeah, and it's where I come from. It's where I met my community of product makers like yourself. And like, why ignore that? I just want to embrace it. I love product. It's just who I am.
Well, me too. And we're in the right place then on this show to talk about it. And I'd love to get into talking about both how to tell the story of the products that we're working on, as well as some of how that can inform the product work that we're doing and the decision we make on our product. But I feel we should give you a chance first to kind of give a little podcast soundbite version of the Adam story so far so people have some context. I'm sure that some folks already know who you are, but for the folks that don't or need a refresher, How do you like to tell that story?
Yeah, the easiest way to start is just as like kind of in the format of an origin story. I had gone to film school. I was always tech obsessed, huge Apple nerd. I worked in visual effects for 6 years and sort of cut my teeth working in the movie industry in post-production capacity, doing some commercials, editing, visual effects, compositing. But during that time, I was just becoming more fascinated and ingrained in the culture of people who were making the web and were making apps in the newly launched app store. So I was always just right on top of that as it was developing. And so I got lucky enough to become friends with some of the people in our community who are making that stuff, some of the notables, you know. And they embraced me, I think, because I was an outsider as a storyteller, as a filmmaker, but I still kind of spoke the language natively to designers and product makers and even engineers. Like my first foray outside of the context of the industry that I came from was that I tried to make an app that was a creative writing tool, a Twitter client essentially called Birdhouse, that was for us nerds who wanted to joke around and make each other laugh to have a tool for capturing our drafts and saving them and publishing them from the app itself, because nothing like that had existed yet. There wasn't even copy and paste on the iPhone at this point.
It's hard to remember like how long ago that was.
Oh my gosh, it was such early days. And just recently I pulled out my iPhone version 1 just to kind of appreciate it as an object again. And I had recalled that in the period of time, I think it was like 6 months between when the iPhone was announced in 2007 to when it was actually available, launched and in stores, I had fashioned like a fabricated mock-up of the thing at to scale, you know, with a printed out face and, you know, front and back. And I kept it in my pocket with me for all of that time because I wanted to know the feeling of carrying it around. I wanted to embrace what it was going to mean in my life as part of my ritual, my everyday carry, so to speak. And I still had that as well. So I have those two objects side by side. We made that app, Birdhouse, me and Cameron Hunt, a friend, designer, developer. And then as part of launching that app on the App Store, I made a little video because that was something that I knew how to do. And the video ended up capturing more attention than the app did and drew in some awesome attention from startups that were developing at the time and even big companies. So I just started getting inbound interest from a bunch of companies making cool new products like Flipboard and Jawbone and Square and even Genentech to come and make a similar video for them because they were working on similar products. So then that just begat this whole company that I was able to accidentally start up and involve, at this point, thousands of people in the film community to help and tell these stories. So I've gotten to simultaneously embrace both of these fascinations, the filmmaking origin and the tech origin, the product origin, and fold both of them in equal amounts into my daily life in a way that just never stops making me happy.
I love it. And that's one of the sort of OG origin stories of a product, effectively, is you tried making one thing and then you had this side thing that was part of that. And then the market said, actually, we want that thing. But the side thing is the thing we want.
Absolutely. I'd be curious proportionally how often that happens, because it seems to be like that's how most great things kind of start. You know, you set out to do one thing. Takes you in a surprising new direction. You adapt. Most importantly is that you're open to adapting to that new opportunity. And then if you're lucky, you adapt again, and then you adapt again. And not because you keep failing, but because you keep seeing new opportunity, because that's how the world works, is this: the puck doesn't only go in one direction. It keeps changing directions, and you kind of skate there and you skate the next place.
Well, also fundamentally, if you're trying to do something totally new, you're going to fail too.
Right? Totally.
At least that's my observation and personal experience. New things are hard.
Oh, absolutely. You can't prescribe what's going to happen.
So I love that as a sort of recap origin. And so since then, you've built out this studio, and you have like 15-ish people, and that's the same size class at Steam Clock, which is cool. Different industry. We're building apps and products, but similar kind of size and mentality. The obvious place to start in terms of sort of topics to talk about is telling stories, because that's what you do. And I think a lot of people who are in the product development world, whether they're product managers or they're founders or whatever their role is, struggle in a way that maybe is either surprising to people who, I mean, it's not surprising to you, you've seen it for 13 years, but people often will struggle telling the story of their own product. You know, they're very excited about it. They're waist deep in it or neck deep in it. They know all 27 features and why they're there and why they're so great. But that's not a story. It's like a duffel bag full of facts that you can just kind of like open up and like...
Yeah, it's an object, yeah.
What approaches can those of us who are waist deep in our own products take to kind of zoom out and tease out what kind of compelling stories we might be able to tell people who are not yet familiar with this great thing that we're building, instead of just saying, here's the 27 things?
Yeah, there's a few ways of formulating this answer, and I'll probably hone in on two of them, but one way of thinking about it is that story is a model for an experience, for a lived experience. Story is a way of condensing a lived experience that you want to share and connect with another person who might have had a similar experience, who might be having a similar experience. Story is a construction that connects the two of you so that you understand what that experience might be in common. I think another way of formulating it is that, you know, people who build products often consider the product as an object and struggle to consider the product as a subject, and subject in the sense that there's a perspective involved and there's a starting point and a journey. You know, maybe a third way of encapsulating this is that an object is sort of how something looks and appears, and a story is how something feels. And I consider that as like sort of like one of the most important core principles of my work, is it's so important to convey how a product feels when you use it. And really in the context of a product, that is how to tell the story. Because a good product makes you feel a certain way. It will change you in some way. It'll change the way you interact with the world. It'll change the way that you see yourself. It'll change your capacity to do things or to know things. And all of those are like, those are really big things. Those are really big feelings. So I think that some people maybe don't have as much of a knack for storytelling because they're not so accustomed to paying attention to how things make them feel necessarily, or having the language to express how those things make them feel. We all feel things. Everybody feels. We have that universal. And a lot of times we feel the same things. But then storytellers, I think, have this innate need to take those feelings and then express them, translate them into language. Because language is how other people know what that feeling is. And so I think that that's what I would say product makers should strive to do in a very abstract way.
Do you feel like being in the product and having maybe worked on it for years makes it easier or harder for people who are in the product to kind of put themselves into the feeling of what somebody who's new to it may be feeling, or to kind of envision what feeling they're trying to evoke, as opposed to maybe the feeling you have once you're many years into something?
Yeah, great question. I think that it's probably a lot harder to do that when you've been with the product for a long time. Because anything, like, what's fun about something new is that it surprises you. And when something surprises you, the way I've heard it phrased scientifically is that you're forced to update your prediction models of the world, because we all go through life sort of predicting how things are going to turn out in every microsecond as a means of survival. Like, what is going to taste good and what is going to kill us? We predict those things along the way, and we predict them based on our lived, you know, the history of our past. So something that surprises you means you get to update your predictive model in a way that now you have new, fresh information for what's going to kill you or not, or what's going to taste good. And that's why we get this jolt of dopamine every time something surprises us and delights us in a good way, is like, oh, ding, 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 we get to update our predictive model. So when that happens, when you're building something new, is like first love. You know, it's like a crush. It's like you are newly exposed to something that gives you existence, that the world is pleasurable to you in a new and exciting way. And naturally, we're just going to pay attention to those things. We're going to pay attention to our own reactions to those things. And we're going to strive to translate those things into language so that we know what we're feeling in that moment. I think that that's a natural impulse. And I think that storytellers are just people who say, oh, not only is it exciting to update my predictive model, it's also exciting to find the right words to capture those, you know, updating my predictive model. Some people really love that, almost like engineering, you know?
I love the finding the right words part is probably my favorite. Definitely one of my favorite things about marketing is that, like, going over a tiny micro piece of copy or a script or something and thinking, like, oh, is this even quite the right way to say it? Or how does this feel when you say the difference between two synonyms or something like that, which sometimes drives my team a little bit nuts that I'm, okay, let's improvise this for a seventh time.
Oh, totally. But you got to do it because it makes a difference. And that's what's fun and delightful about being a human. I've been thinking about this a lot in regards to language models. Like, language is such that if the only goal was to communicate an idea, we would always only ever use the same words to communicate that idea. But instead, we have infinite permutations of ways to communicate that idea. And so we want to surprise ourselves in new and surprising ways and permutations of communicating that idea, because that's fun. That's play for us.
I'd never thought about this interaction in between how, like, large language models like GPT and surprise in communication, because if you look at especially GPT-4, which is the sort of newest, greatest as of the time of this recording, and, you know, in 6 minutes probably there'll be yet another thing. A part of the times that are most memorable when you interact with it is when it surprises you. And that is, I've never connected that to the observation that when you're trying to communicate something to somebody, if you say it in a cliche way that they've heard 100 times, it actually tends to just kind of roll over them and not get absorbed, because it's like noise, right?
Yeah.
Which is part of what marketing is. It's like, how do I say something maybe that they've already heard before, but in a way that actually lands because they haven't heard it said that way before? And that part of the sort of joy, or I guess horror, depending on your perspective, of GPT and things like that, is that it can at times surprise us in a delightful way, which is not the case with, you know, previous 5 years ago versions of language generation.
Totally. That's why, like, when people try to describe GPT or a language model as a calculator of words, it doesn't hit the mark because a calculator will always repeatably give you the same result given the same input. But a language model processes words based on the context of its environment, and its environment is always changing. And like if you start to dig into how language models actually work and how they encode words into numbers and then give different numbers different weights so that they're attracted to each other based on their similarity of meaning, like that will work just as physics in the real world will work, is that physical properties work in relation to their environment, in the context of their environment. And I'm like really into this idea that ideas have a shape, you know? Ideas have a shape and a force and an energy to them. And so two ideas are going to attract to each other and form a shape in one point in time, different, given a set of inputs, different to how they'll attract each other, you know, different point in time, given the same set of inputs. I really love the shape of things. Like ideas having shape is just like top of mind for me right now.
Do you go as far as to like try to express like terms for shape? Like this is a spiky idea or a round idea, or am I taking it too literally?
No. That's a great thought. I don't personally do that. I think that the words like the reason like spiky and soft and stuff like that, the reason those words apply is because the shape of ideas across our different senses are similar to each other, right? Spiky mm-hmm. is the same as hot, as the same as sharp. That alone should tell us the way that ideas have similar shapes in relation to each other, even across different disciplines. So I think like the goal of humanity being to form connection and to figure out some sort of like universal principles about how things are connected to each other in useful ways. Like it's so fun to figure out what are the associative connections between disparate things. I just love that. Like we went into a very abstract place quickly, like, but
but I love it.
You know, synesthesia or whatever it is. It's like, why does one word very descriptively fit a certain concept and another one doesn't? And you know, because a word can have a sound and the sound can have a shape and the shape can match the shape of another descriptive word. And
Well, even the sounds of words, like there've been some research where they'll tell people nonsense words and then they'll ask them about the meaning of those words. And then you'll get consistent answers. Like the famous one was like, this is a boba and this is a kiki. And then it's like, and then you have the shapes and then they're like, oh, no, definitely kiki is the spiky one and boba is the round one. And people generally agree with that.
Yeah, I saw that. There was a brand guy, right, doing that talk. And it was like, which one of these is a citrus drink, you know, brand and which, yeah.
So moving a layer back up of abstraction or back down, or what direction if abstract is up or down
to the real world. Yeah.
We have this goal, as we were talking about, of telling the stories of the products that we're building and the emotions behind them and how does it make you feel, right? And so I'm curious, you've been at this for 14 years. You've been telling the stories of all sorts of products. You've seen some really great, famous, successful products. You've probably seen some less successful products in that time that you did not make videos for.
Or there are a few.
Maybe passed on.
Oh, I have made videos. Have made plenty of videos for non-successful products, yeah.
I'm curious what perspective that's given you in terms of how the need to eventually tell that story to people who aren't yet familiar with your product could or should or might inform those of us that are making products today, when we're, because you are interacting with people once at the point they already have the product. No, typically, I assume they're not like at the whiteboarding stage. They're not at the early prototype. They're like, okay, now we have a marketing budget. But thinking in terms of how you're building this product and how are you putting it together and how are you forming it, basically, have you developed anything, thoughts around how the need to eventually tell that story in a simple, crisp way, and not just here's 27 features, should or could inform people's product work?
Yeah, absolutely. It's the same principle as storytelling. I think that you as a product maker want to pay very close attention to how you want your user to feel when they're touching every single part of the product. And I'll give you two examples. One is very near to me because right now I'm doing a startup and I'm building a product, and I was just before this call, I was on with our UX designer and we were having some high level sort of philosophical questions about the product. And he asked me, what do you want people to feel? What are some descriptive words? What do you want people to feel when they're using the product? And it, my product happens to be in my industry, my category of filmmaking. And one thing that I realized when I became a director is that the director's job is not to make the right decision along the way. The director's job is to make a decision and then move on to the next decision. And the reason that making a decision is the most important thing is because there are so many people around you that are waiting on you in order to do the next part of their work, right? And this applies to any leader, whether creative or business or anything. People are relying on you to confidently make a decision so that they can proceed to their next task or choice. So I realized that what I want to imbue into my product is that users feel like the product is making a confident decision on their behalf or helping them make a confident decision. Doesn't have to be the right decision, but it has to be made with confidence and some authority and awareness of the environment. So that ends up being kind of a thoughtful perspective when building a product is I want my users to feel cared for. I want my users to feel like if they press a button, it's going to be it's going to do something that's not disastrous for them or whatever it is. So that's one example of a condition in my category. But some years ago, I was talking to somebody young who was like looking to get into copywriting in advertising. And we were just talking about like, how do you do this? You know, cause like when you're young, you just like, maybe you talk to somebody you admire and you go like,
yeah,
how did you start? And then what
you're
do
like,
you do?
Well, you need to go back to 2007 and get an iPhone and.
Exactly. Exactly. Like, yeah, a lot of my tips and insights are not very instructive because they rely on like being friends with like Merlin Mann. And John Gruber and then like getting early access to like cool startup. That's not going to happen for most people. So I was in the right place at the right time. But what I did come up with for this young person, which was like a really good conversation, was like, okay, let's imagine a product that exists and then think about whether it was just released and how would you think about the story and how does it make you feel? And what I came up with was a stoplight, like a traffic light, right?
Okay.
The traffic light doesn't exist. And then suddenly you see like you see a link to a landing page that it's announcing the traffic light. And this is what it does. And these are some of the features. And most importantly, let's get to the core of how it makes you feel. And that was a useful exercise because how a traffic light makes you feel is a sense of order, control, safety, and power, right? Empowerment, that when you get that green light, you're allowed to proceed and you can do so safely. Like it was a longer conversation. We like even came up with some brand language around it and some, you know, marketing copy. And it was really fun. But I would say like that as an exercise for product makers is step back from the product that you sort like you've been involved in building for so long that you know intimately every line of code and every draft of every feature. And think about, come to it with fresh eyes as a new user, that as though you've just been exposed to this thing or this product or this feature, and what is it that you want somebody who's brand new to it to feel along the way, unconsciously or consciously?
What's your take on this habit that some companies do? I know Amazon at least used to do this, where they'll have a press release they'll write for the product before they make the product of like, okay, this is what's going to happen. This thing is coming out and it's going to make this way easier and it's going to have these benefits to you. Have you seen people use that habit in a useful way? And what are your thoughts on it?
Yeah. I mean, even I did, I did a couple of videos for eBay for the like kind of a R&D team that was dreaming up cool products on the roadmap that didn't exist yet. And they hired me to make a commercial for these things. It, like typically in my category, I would call them those vision videos.
Right.
But vision videos are more often like these anthemic statements of what's coming what the future is. I've done plenty of those, but these ones specifically for eBay were like imagining that the product already exists and now I'm just going to demo it for you using the tools at my disposal. And that was interesting. That was this really cool guy leading that team whose name was Dane, and he was writing a book and like a whole set of materials on Previz. And Previz is short for Previz Visualization. Previz is more, I think, connected to my previous industry, visual effects.
Mm.
A lot of filmmakers will do Previz, like basically really rough CG renders, animated CG renders of all their shots to cut everything together so that they can feel what it's going to look like before they actually do the thing. But as a product maker within eBay, he was forming this whole, you know, sort of structured practice around Previz. And that's why he came to me and we did like essentially a Previz for one of these products that eBay was going to be working on. And I think it's very useful. Is it something that I do as a product maker? No, not necessarily, because I'm a very lazy person and I like to conserve energy. So I find that like I don't have enough energy to like do dreamy dreams of like fake, you know, placeholder things that are going to maybe exist and then adapt in, you know, along the way. I tend to like to work with real materials in order to do the work. You know, I just don't like to I don't like to do a lot of work that's not going to be used in the final thing.
Do you storyboard out when you're doing a video though?
Yeah, perfect example. We don't unless we absolutely have to.
Unless you need to for like approval or something.
Yeah, for clients really like to have storyboards sometimes. Often clients in the tech context, they say storyboards on those intro calls because they know that word.
Right. They've seen some documentary about Pixar.
Exactly. And they just think that storyboard is part of everything that you do. It's totally not. Like, you know, a lot of times you just write a script and then you shoot the script. Or you write a script and then you do a shot list based on the script so that the crew knows what shots need to be captured and the first AD can plan what order they will be captured. Those things are very important for organizational structure and for strategic planning. Storyboarding is, in my world, it can be a luxury. It's great actually when you have it. But it's resource intensive and sometimes it's like too prescriptive. One important part of our process is before the shoot day, we'll get all of the key people from the crew together in the location, in the set, and it's called a tech scout. And during the tech scout, everybody talks through the shoot and talks through the shots that you're going to get and talks through the camera angles. And you sort of plan where the camera is going to go at every phase, because not only is that important for where to put the camera and the lights, it's also important for where to put the crew and the cast and the client. And like, you have to know where all these organizational pieces are going to go. So that's why you do that strategic planning during the tech scout. And then often we'll capture, like we'll just use our phones and we'll shoot mocked up frames with, you know, crew just standing in for the talent. And those are called photo boards. And then those photo boards will be on the thumbnail on the schedule, the shoot schedule. And so, yeah, that in itself is a form of previz. It's just like a low lift way of doing previz.
It's difficult when you talk to people who build products on a 3-person or a 10-person startup team versus a 10,000-person corporation. And the amount of like previz, yeah. Like previz becomes, it's not the term that a lot of product teams will use, but like previz ends up being more and more and more important the larger your organization, just as a alignment mechanism. If you have a 10,000-person organization, you don't need all 10,000 people to be on board, but you need some like chain of people up from you up to some decision maker and budget holders and things like that. And then other departments that have other things that they may or may not have on their mind other than this thing that you want to rally people in a common direction. Whereas if you're all metaphorically in the same room, whether or not you physically are, but if you're a one-digit number of people on a team, often you can have a couple people be like, this is going to be the thing. And then people are like, great, let's do it. And then they actually do it.
Yeah, which is so fun. Like that spirit of that kind of making is so fun and great. And because you can take risks, you can experiment. You don't have to be, not everybody's so fearful of accountability. And often great things are made that way. But also, if you have the right tools available to get everybody together on a shared vision, that can also be a great way to do it.
So we've touched a couple times about the team that's required. You know, you'd mentioned, I think at one point, 1,000 people that you've worked with at various levels and depths in doing all this work over the years.
It's 7,000. We tallied it recently for a deck I was working on, is around 7,000 freelance production people that we've brought in on our stuff over the years.
Which is amazing. So congratulations on that. I find one of the common topics that we have in this show, and I find always really interesting to talk to different leaders about how they think about it, is how people think about talent and people and the team. And any leader worth their salt will say this is important. Like, we know it's important. But how do you think about finding great people to work with, setting them up for success, and maybe even like letting them spread their wings to the degree that that's feasible?
Oh my God, it's so crucial. And I love when it happens. It's fun to spot the talent before the talent necessarily knows that they've been spotted, you know? It's fun to find those people that are like sort of early in their career. And that doesn't necessarily mean young. It just means early, you know? Early could become, look, in the context of a second career, second or third career. But spotting people who have something to contribute and a different perspective on things that you've never seen before, and then the motivation to do something different. I love that. That's what I look for in people that I'm working with, is the ones that have just that energy to think through a problem and a little bit of confidence to bring that approach to you and say, I don't know if this is the right thing, but you're the boss, and like, this is the way I was thinking about it. So what do you think about this? And even if they're wrong, even if their solution was probably not the most successful one, I love that spirit of taking a risk, thinking about it differently, and inventing something because that's fun for you, not because it was a task to complete, not because you had a job to do. Certainly not because you're putting in the time and, you know, order to make the paycheck, but because solving the problem was fun to you. Those are the people that I look for to add value in my team, whatever it is. God, that's how all great things are made. People that just say, I see the problem. I know what it is. I see it in front of me. And this is how I think I'm going to solve it. What do you think? I love it.
Rather than waiting for maybe a consensus or something like that. You know?
Yeah. And sometimes that's out of fear. And that comes earlier in your career too, when you're afraid that, you know, you're afraid that your boss is going to get upset if you suggest something and it's out of place or it's not your place, which don't work for that boss. Sometimes it really is because you're so fresh, you're so green to it that you don't even know what the language is behind solving a problem. Like, I was certainly there. I remember my first internship when I was still in film school. It was a long time ago. I was working for this documentarian. We were doing like a medical industrial, and we were in somebody's hospital room. And he was interviewing with a camera crew and everything. He was interviewing this subject, and he was doing it very well, very gracefully. He was an older guy. He'd been doing it for decades. And he had a 35 millimeter film camera because he always took it everywhere to just capture some stills that might be used on the marketing materials or whatever. And here I am, a kid in film school. When we were done with the interview, he said, okay, take some pictures of him, the subject. And I grabbed the camera, and I was in a photo class in school, and I must have taken like 40 seconds adjusting the focus and making sure the exposure was right. And my boss was like, what the hell are you doing with, like, give me that. And he just took the camera out of my hands. He started clicking away like a photojournalist, you know? And it was in that moment I realized how much I had to learn, I guess, you know, like a level of expertise. That's another core principle, is this idea of expertise. Once you've been doing it for a little longer, you know, you realize that you can make more decisions quicker and adjust, that you can correct for errors very quickly and instinctively. So you don't have to take 40 seconds to adjust the focus and the exposure. You can step in and make micro adjustments as you go and iterate very quickly. And like, that's expertise, is like making decisions quickly, knowing exactly in advance the micro adjustments you need to make while you're doing it, and then performing, solving the problem, moving on.
The ability to make decisions quickly and move on is something that I think you were touching on this before, that often as a leader, your biggest value you can have is not to make the perfect decision and spend some arbitrary amount of time making a perfect decision, but making a decision. And then ideally it can be adjusted later. You haven't like permanently doomed everyone off a cliff. That's something that I hadn't really appreciated very well until my team got to a certain size. When we were small, I could spend probably an unreasonable amount of time thinking about certain things and we survived. But you get to a certain point where I can't make every decision. And I certainly can't make the perfect of every decision because just I'm one human being with a certain amount of time. And so obviously delegating is part of that. But a big part of it is like you say, is like the faster that you can make a decision, the faster we can switch our attention to a more important decision or execution on a direction that we'll actually learn something from, instead of sitting in a seventh meeting with nine people debating something.
Totally. All of that waste. Yeah, just move quickly and with confidence. I agree. And yeah, the ability to delegate to people that you trust, not necessarily to make the exact same decision that you would, but to make an equally informed expert decision that you know will put everybody forward in a good direction. That's invaluable.
How has that path been for you? Someone, you know, founder of the company, at times the face of the company in a more literal way than a lot of founders of their companies are. You've gotten to a point now, you know, with 16 people and thousands of people work for you. Obviously, you're not in every decision. You're not vetting and green lighting every single check of everything. But I'm sure also you still have, or I assume you're anything like me or most founders, that you still have an emotional investment on a quality bar and these sorts of things.
Of course.
So how is that path look like for you in terms of giving people as more and more freedom, and like where have been the limits and boundaries and challenges of that for you as you've attempted to give people the ability to make decisions that you might not make?
Totally. I mean, it's an attempt, right? You're never going to get, I don't think I'm going to get it right on the first try, but that's where I am right now. You know, I'm starting another company, and part of starting another company is I can't give equal care and a focus to both companies. Something's got to give. And the new company needs most of my attention. But luckily, I've spent so many years with these people, building up these creative practices in these best guiding principles that I trust them. And what I've learned is that good things happen when you let go a little bit. Not all the way. I still need to be there. It's like still my, you know, if nothing else, it's my fiduciary duty. As though I had shareholders. You know, it's my fiduciary duty to the financial health of my company to still care about what comes out of it.
Well, no one wants to work for someone who doesn't care.
No, totally. Yeah, like that's something that I'm incredibly fearful of, is that anybody on my team at Sandwich thinks that like suddenly they become the ignored, you know, child or something. As the, you know, I kind of think of it the way when Steve Jobs split off to work on the Mac, I'm sure his Apple team kind of felt neglected in some way, but
they did.
Of course he cared. Of course he cared. And the reason he gave himself that freedom, I'm sort of speculating, but some of the reason he gave himself that freedom is because he knew that to some degree they had it. You know, the Apple was like, it was like on its way, you know, it was doing okay. And now was his time to go and investigate somewhere else.
I haven't written or talked too much about this yet, but I've been on a similar path, as you know, of running this product studio for 12, 13 years. And this team here has been doing such great work that I'm lucky enough that I have been able to shift more and more of my attention to building the next thing, building a product. But it brings up so many challenges and questions around like things that I used to do that were unsustainable. And was it even important for me to be part of this decision anyway? For 13 years, I've been the one who's decided what the illustration, not personally, like not line by line, but I've been like in the feedback loop for, well, what does this illustration look like? And what is this marketing thing, you know, I'm proofreading the blog post before they go out. And it's like, maybe that's not important.
Totally. I'm right there with you. Yeah. I think about all of the things that I was so confident in my need to make that decision that easily they could have gone better if I wasn't involved in it. So, you know, like there's that like opening yourself up to that opportunity to take the risk, separate yourself, and have it go maybe even better than if you were there in it.
One of the sort of stereotypical business things you'll get as a founder or a leader who is giving more independence to your team is to shift your attention from the details, like you and I have a bit, I think, a bit of an instinct to want to make sure those details are hitting a quality bar, and shifting your attention more towards impact or results, a more quantified way of looking at, is this thing succeeding, which gives the team that's executing for you more latitude to achieve those results without necessarily having to wonder, well, how would Adam do this? Like, would he make this thing purple or not? Have you moved in that direction much? Have you been experimenting with it? Is that just kind of like a pipe dream MBA speak, or I don't know how you think about that?
Yeah, I'm not like an MBA kind of a thinker. So like, I forget the words you used for it, but I'm not thinking big picture. I'm thinking very big picture in terms of the story of my company. But I'm not thinking big picture in terms of like results oriented. I have no idea what's going to generate more results in the marketplace. I have zero idea, and I don't have very much interest in it other than I want my company to survive. I'm the type of person who thinks that the execution is going to drive the results, and so like it's more in my interest to focus and obsess more about the execution than the results, I guess. Does that make sense?
It makes total sense, because I'm the same way, except I'm increasingly in a position where if I'm spending less time executing and have the team executing on my own behalf, I found, and it's sort of, I think, a stereotypical challenge, I found it harder to be in the loop in terms of helping ensure, if you delegating to someone or giving someone freedom, you sort of necessarily need to give them more accountability as well. You know, if I'm going to say you're going to be leading up this thing and you're going to be making bigger decisions about it, there has to be some sort of like expectation of, and the decisions will be good, or like, what does good mean? But like, you know.
Yeah, totally. Yeah. Step up to the plate. It's big kid stuff. So, you know, I totally agree. Hopefully a person as a leader has fostered that kind of a culture. The jury's out yet still. I don't know whether
these stories are being written still.
Yeah, they still are. And I think like when I say like big picture thinking, I think it's my job to decide, because everything is changing so swiftly all the time in tech, in media, so we can go in different directions, and it's my job to sort of steer the company on a new course and identify new opportunities, and then say that one is worth pursuing because there could be something big on, you know, in that direction. That's my favorite part of having a company, and always has been.
That's strategy. That's totally. MBA speak. Yeah. That's strategy. That's the biggest founder leader input, is like, okay, we got a bunch of options, helping figure out where are the ones where the big opportunities are and where are the ones that are maybe a distraction, you know?
Yeah. That's it. I love strategy. I love creative strategy, and I love business strategy too.
Maybe this is a perfect line from this idea of creative and product strategy, because you've been getting more and more into this loop with startups, which, you know, you've accepted equity over the years for a portion of payment for some of the videos that you've done over the years, and that has done okay for you, as I understand it, with some of the great startups that you've worked with. And you're doing this more intentionally now, setting out a program and saying, hey, you know, we're Sandwich or Sandwich Video, and you can work with us in this way, and making kind of more explicit. But do you see yourselves as evaluating these businesses that are applying to this program that you have? Do you evaluate them similarly to the way that like a VC or an investor would, in that you're trying to, okay, well, maybe try to just gauge like, okay, is this going to be a $1 billion company or not? And then you just use the best guesses and maybe a spreadsheet to try and figure that out? Or are you looking at it from a more like sort of storytelling, marketing perspective, because that's the lens that you come on things from?
I think equal. I think a traditional investor is going to mostly look at the business opportunity, which in itself is a cool story. But as a filmmaker, I'm looking for what is going to be the best story to tell. And by investing creative capital, so to speak, into this company, I need to make sure that there's going to be some value of, you know, in my creative capital. And I need to make sure that I'm given the best material with which to spend that creative capital. So equal parts, you know, I love telling a great story, but I also love telling a great story because this great story can make a good business. I think investors intuitively know that a company with a great story is going to have a stronger chance of being a great business, but they're not in the place to help tell that story necessarily. But we, like, very literally are in a good place to help tell that story, which is why it makes sense for us, why this model makes sense for us.
Something that comes to mind for me, and curious your take on this, is that I could see an argument either way for your leaning towards working with startups. That on one hand, if you could think of a startup that's just like a pure marketing play, like the famous like Grey Goose story where they started with like the idea of like, let's make a vodka company. Oh, okay, where should we make the vodka? Well, I've heard there's these like rocks in champagne that we could like filter our champagne France that we could filter our vodka through. Okay, do that. Like a totally manufactured thing and with the, like marketing first. And then, oh, I guess we need to make some vodka at the end, where marketing, of course, made the company, which was, you know, very financially successful. And so I could see an argument for you as storytellers to leaning towards marketing centric, almost like commoditized things where the marketing is, makes a difference. But on the other hand, I could see you leaning, making an argument that where storytelling skill is going to make the most difference is if you have something that's more ambitious and more surprising and more unusual. It's like, you know, this is like fusion power for your backyard. Like, you wouldn't think that's possible, but like, trust me, here's how it's going to work.
Yeah.
So do you have a leaning one way or another, or how do you tend to interpret where you can have the highest impact, I guess?
Like, as an investor, I prefer the companies that feel like the solution was right there in front of you the whole time. You know, like, it's a very clear, digestible problem that is easy to put into words. And the solution was new and different and inventive, but it seems in retrospect so obvious. Those are my favorite. The pie in the sky fusion in your, you know, in your backyard, those are harder for me to swallow because they often involve a technical understanding, like in terms of the inventiveness of the execution that isn't necessarily in my wheelhouse. It's been fun to see the applicants in this, the program that you mentioned. We called it the Breadwinner Fellowship. Like, they're all sort of like my favorite ones. They're solving a problem that's very easy to put into words, to wrap your head around, and they're solving it in a unique and inventive way that in retrospect makes so much sense. And all they had to do was go and find the resources to make that solution happen. And now it's a business and it's a very clear story to tell. I love those. Like, simplicity is everything. To me, that's inherent in the product that I'm working with too. And everybody I've told about it in my industry has been like, yeah, this probably should have existed a long time ago.
Right.
You know, and it just hasn't yet. So, like, that, yeah, that's my favorite type of story to tell, my favorite type of business to invest in.
Yeah, it makes a lot of sense. Simplicity is one of the things I always go back to when I'm talking about marketing things, whether it's a single page or an entire brand or whatever it is working on marketing-wise, is I'm almost always like, you know, you have this strong temptation to add more. Oh, but it can also do this, and it can also do this, and there's this cool thing. But at the end of the day, like, people are going to remember like two or three words about your thing.
Totally. Or the other mistake is trying to tell too much story to too many people instead of telling one small story that can apply to everybody.
If you're the bookkeeper, then this. If you're the accountant, then this. If you're the CEO, then this. Yeah. If you're the factory worker, then this. It's like, okay. What?
It's a lot. And you would think that by now, like, that by this many years of tech marketing, people would know better, but you still see seasoned marketing people making the same types of mistakes.
Okay, well, that makes a lot of sense. And I'm really curious to see what comes out of these companies. I think you and I have talked a bit before, and I feel this is like where the smart money is right now, that this moment we're in 2023, there's a lot of building going on, and there's some really awesome products and startups being founded right now, which just tends to happen when the froth recedes and there's a bit of a reset. People get heads down and start making stuff that's going to turn out, that is already great, but we don't yet know it was great. But once it hits its stride in the next 2 to 4 years, we're going to be seeing some really cool stuff.
Absolutely. I love this time. I call it build mode, and this is where all the value is created. And this is when it's exciting to be around technology.
Me too. So, last question. I want to talk briefly about mistakes, because that's how we learn. They're fun. They make good stories. And so I'm curious if you can think of any memorable mistakes you've made that you'd be willing to share on a podcast that you've learned something from.
Sure. My job is to try to see the vision before the vision is necessarily real. And so a lot of the mistakes that I've made in terms of companies that I've worked with, in terms of people that I've worked with, is projecting too much of myself and my hopes and dreams on that company or person without having really done the due diligence and having enough evidence to have seen the limitations. And sometimes that bites me in the butt. It's easy to talk about mistakes that I made early because of too much confidence and too much arrogance. And I thought, oh yeah, I've got this. You know, in the first few years of my company, I just kind of thought like I was batting 1,000 and I just knew exactly what to do. And I couldn't have been more wrong. Crucially, I thought that I always knew better than my clients. You know, I always thought that the clients were not to be listened to, or the clients were going to have their input and then you summarily ignore the input. And then it was some years down the road, and it was, his name is Halli Thorleifsson, the founder of Weno, the design agency.
Right.
Right. The Icelandic design agency. And then famously or infamously, he got acquired by Twitter. And then like he and Musk got into a flame war.
Mm-hmm. Which Musk lost.
Publicly. Right. Exactly. I mean, like he couldn't have come out looking more poorly. And Halli triumphed. Anyway, like I got to meet him and talk with him for a little while at one of the XOXO conferences. And he told me that like one of the greatest things that happened to his agency was that he figured out how to stop fighting the clients and how to work with them. And during a time when I was still fighting my clients because I thought I knew better than them. When I started to embrace like the collaborative spirit of working with clients and taking from them what you kind of intuitively know will add value to the thing you're working on, at the same time having the benefit of making them feel good and heard and seen and respected, then like that kind of changed the game for my company. So I would say, I can't think of any specific. No, I can think of a specific. One time, I mean, like literally I was on a call with like, so we had done this commercial for a fintech related thing and we had temp music in there, sort of like a swing jazz kind of thing. And then I brought in my favorite composer, Alex Weinstein, to make a track like in the same idiom that was like going to be custom and shaped perfectly. And the client said, we just like want to go back to the one you had in there.
Just the temp music,
and I
please.
Temp music, please. And I got so belligerent and reactive to them. And I said, you don't pay me for your taste. You pay me for my taste. And the client was like, literally like, you went too far. That, like the client told me like, no, not okay. Bad, bad creative studio founder. And I had no choice in that time, but to listen. And because like we never worked together again, it like definitely reflected poorly on me. That founder probably went off and said something negative about me to the next founder if they were asked.
This Adam guy thinks he knows everything. And
yeah, totally. That's my biggest fear, is like being like this arrogant prick in the category that gets a bad reputation. You know, you want to be delightful and to work with. That's should be the number one goal. It should be fun for everybody.
Yeah, I love that said explicitly, because it's something that I think a lot of people come to maybe not until they're in the middle of their careers, is realizing that it's not just like try to get work that you can be proud of, but also make it the people that you work with are glad that they worked with you is like maybe even more important, because then you can work with really great people and then you can do even better work.
Totally. I will like not know the source of the quote. People remember how you made them feel.
But people do remember how you made them feel. And that is creates this flywheel effect over a career where over time, you know, like you say, people talk to one another. Oh, hey, I'm looking for my next gig. Should I work with Adam? Should I work with Alan? Should I work with so-and-so? And how you made people feel, you know, it's not just like this hand-wavy thing. It's like fundamental thing. People are choosing their life's work and how they want to feel while they're doing it. It's a good way to comport yourself. So I love that as a mistake and paired lesson. Awesome. Well, thanks, Adam. This has been delightful. Where can people go to learn more about you and your work?
Thank you, Alan. This has been delightful for me too. I love this kind of conversation, and I love you as a person. So thank you very much for inviting me to do this. Easiest place, like my compendium of everything, is at myname.com, adamlisigor.com, or just sandwich.co. I'm trying to not do social stuff anymore. I'm on Mastodon. That's fun.
Yeah, Mastodon. Yeah.
I'm so excited for sort of like the phasing out of an era of the social web. It was just so toxic for our culture in almost every way. And certainly like we built so much from it. Like all of my good friends in like this internet capacity I met through Twitter. But it's so fun to see that the end of the toxified version of that is finally happening.
Well, looking forward to seeing what new thing replaces it in a way that hopefully we've learned something from the mistakes of the previous generation.
Yeah, agreed.
Thank you so much for being on the show, Adam. It Shipped That Way is brought to you by Steam Clock Software. If you're a growing business and your customers need a really nice mobile app, get in touch with Steam Clock. That's it for today. You can give us feedback, follow us on social media, or rate the show by going to itshipped.fm/contact. We'd love to hear what you like, what kind of episodes you're enjoying, particular guests that you'd love to hear. Until next time, keep shipping.